This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan, filling in for Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about how colleges and universities in Indiana are handling the COVID-19 pandemic. Later in the show, we'll talk to a student from University of Notre Dame about his experience being on campus, and we'll also talk to public health experts working with universities about testing strategies and the safety measures they're taking. But now we're joined by Maria Leonteras, editor-in-chief of The Observer from St. Mary's College. It's the independent student newspaper for Notre Dame, St. Mary's, and Holy Cross. So, Maria, last month, your paper published an editorial titled, "Don't Make Us Write Obituaries." How did The Observer come together to write this?
So, Tuesday of the week we wrote the piece, so that was Tuesday, August 18th, Notre Dame, for like the week before and like leading up to that day, had been seeing big spikes in positive confirmed COVID cases. And so that Tuesday, Notre Dame's president, Father John Jenkins, did a virtual announcement to the community, whoever was on that link at that time, and said that classes at Notre Dame would be all going remote for 2 weeks, and students would essentially have to shelter in place wherever they live on or off campus. Very few people were able to like go onto campus and all of that stuff. And so that also led to a shift in like group activity guidelines, like safety guidelines for all of our campuses. Like they limited the number of people who can meet in groups and all of that. So after that announcement happened, the editorial board had an emergency Zoom meeting and we got on Zoom and we were already planning an editorial for the week for Friday. But after that announcement, we were like, okay, like we need to rethink what we're going to say. Like, this is a really big change on our campus, like our campuses. Like, what are we going to say now? One of the editors, Alicia Silva, she's the Viewpoint editor. She said, "I have an idea for a headline. Don't make us write obituaries." And all of us on the Zoom just kind of like sat there for a second and we were like, oh, yeah, like, if anything were to happen, like we would be writing obituaries. And like, of course we have written obituaries in the past and they're all very tragic, but it hits a little different when it's the middle of a pandemic. So we decided to go with that headline and we built our editorial around this idea of like the shared responsibility everyone in our tri-campus community holds and making sure the situation doesn't get worse and making sure everyone can stay as safe and healthy as possible. At the time, Notre Dame had just announced that they were going to start surveillance testing students and other members of the community. And so one thing we said was like, you know, all three of our campuses should have had surveillance testing in place when we arrived on campus. Our campuses should have prepared like for an outbreak, if an outbreak were to occur. Our dashboards online that represent like our daily COVID cases need more information. Like we just want transparency from everyone. Students need to be more responsible. Administration can't blame everything on the students, that kind of stuff. So that was how that story editorial came to be.
You know, you write in the piece that the blame does not fall with just one party. And everybody is kind of making this up as we go along. Do you feel, though, that we just are not prepared to be handling this on college campuses?
I think, you know, there's no way to really know what will work and what won't work until you're back on the scene and, like, all the variables are happening all at once. So, of course, like, at the beginning of the semester, everyone was doing the best that they could with the knowledge they had, but there are some things that weren't in place that we thought should have been like surveillance testing and those kinds of things. But as like the semester's going on and like guidelines are changing and like the colleges are seeing how like students are reacting and students are like seeing what life on campus is like, you know, we're all adjusting and moving forward as best as we can. So I do think the situation is getting better. Knock on wood, the COVID cases on our campuses have not been spiking like they were those few weeks ago. So things are getting better.
You write about the lack of transparency from the administrations. Can you talk a little bit about that and why that really is so important?
Yeah, so one thing we really wanted from administration was just a breakdown of like these numbers, like how many people are in quarantine and isolation, like how many beds are available. What's the like demographic breakdown of the students who have tested positive? What dorms are they from? What are their majors? Like those kinds of things, like maybe not their majors, but like, you know, just like a little bit more information about that. And like, they had to have had like these like numbers about the risks and things like that about coming back to campus. Like we'd love to see those too. It just feels like, you know, the more information that the administration could provide, like the more people can see that, like can track what's happening on their own and not just have to rely on an email, like a weekly email update. Like people can go look and see numbers online and decide for themselves, like how the situation is looking and stuff like that. So like transparency is key in making sure that like people are aware of what's actually going on. So,
you know, besides the headline, don't make us write obituaries. At the end of the piece, don't make us write a tri-campus employee's obituary. Don't make us write an administrator's obituary, and on and on. It could be anyone.
Because, you know, a college community is more than just 20-something-year-old students who could possibly bounce back from getting sick. Like, there are the people who work so hard to clean our dorms and the people who work in the dining halls and like everyone who's making sure our classrooms are clean. There are professors, there are other staff members. You know, it's not just kids on these campuses, young adults on these campuses. So that was another thing. We just really wanted people to recognize that the situation is like beyond themselves. Like it's a community, and like as a community, we have to take care of each other and everyone in the community, not just a certain group of people.
Now, this got national attention. We saw a number of national outlets covering your piece here. Did that surprise you?
Yeah, it did. Like, I personally never like do anything with the intention of like going viral or anything like that. Like, we just want, you know, as journalists, you want to tell the stories that need to be told and like help amplify other people's voices and opinions. And, you know, editorials are one place where the editorial board of the Observer gets to, you know, share their group opinion. So, whenever we have something we'd like to say, we do it through our editorials. And that was something we wanted to say. We never thought it would be like this big thing, and, you know, news outlets would be contacting us. You know, it's very strange to go from interviewer to interviewee. So that was, yeah, it was a crazy experience.
Notre Dame was, you know, in the headlines just generally. I think it was one of the first colleges that kind of went back, and we saw that immediate spike. So that might have contributed to why there was some attention into your neck of the woods. You said things are getting better there now. Do you feel that way? I mean, how are things today on campus?
Yeah, I definitely do think things are getting better from what we can see with case numbers and those kinds of things. You know, St. Mary's just had their first confirmed case since the beginning of September today. So St. Mary's is pretty solid, steady. Notre Dame numbers aren't going up that much every day. I think today there were 6 confirmed positive cases from the day before. So numbers, thankfully, have, you know, been staying relatively low. Like, obviously, it's not great that cases are increasing at all, but it's better than 80-something cases every day. I do definitely think that the surveillance testing that Notre Dame has been doing for the past few weeks now has really helped. I hope that students are, you know, taking the guidelines more seriously. Like after we had those 2 weeks of remote classes, I feel like everyone is doing their part to make sure everything, like everyone is staying safe and make sure things can stay like as relatively like healthy and all of that as it possibly can.
You think students are getting the message? I mean, on the back of the paper, it says that no more parties. Is that happening?
You know, of course, like not everyone is going to follow the rules. You know, people might still be going out and things like that. But I do think more people are being more cautious than when that initial spike hit.
Besides the surveillance testing, what do you think is going right?
I think the administration has been responding well from what I can observe to what, you know, to the situation. Like it's hard being in charge of all of these people and like being the person that when something goes wrong is automatically blamed. I think at least at St. Mary's, like all of our professors, like, well, professors across the board have just been wonderful. Like they're adapting so well to this situation. Like they're doing their best for the students. And, you know, I can never thank professors enough for being so flexible and understanding at this time. You know, like professors have made their courses flexible and adaptable to the situation. So like if you're not feeling well one day and your class is an in-person class, you can hop on Zoom or like Blackboard, our like class site. And, you know, you can still attend class, but like stay in your room just in case like something's going on or like things like that. Like everyone's been super accommodating for students who need to be away for whatever reason.
Maria Leon Terrace is editor-in-chief of The Observer from St. Mary's. Maria, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you so much.
We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about COVID-19 on college campuses. Up next, we'll be joined by a student at Notre Dame to talk about his experience. If you have questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Jill Sheridan, filling in for Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan, filling in for Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about life on college campus during the pandemic. We'd love your questions and comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. We're joined now by Michael Dugan. He's a senior and Dylan Hall Senator from the University of Notre Dame. Michael, hi, welcome today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, first off, can you please tell me what you do as a senator for a residence hall? Very prestigious.
Yeah, so the Student Senate at Notre Dame is the legislative body of the undergraduate student government. It's responsible for formulating and advancing the undergraduate student body's positions on all issues concerning campus life. There's a few ways we do this. One way is by passing binding orders, by using groups that we create by putting regulations on them and seeing what they can do, but also by passing non-binding resolutions, calling on various administration officials to do things and really stating the voice of the average student at Notre Dame.
So one of those resolutions recently you helped introduce that called for transparency from the school. Can you talk me through that?
Yeah. So on August 20th, I and one of my colleagues introduced a resolution calling for Notre Dame to publish modeling on fall semester 2020 with regards to coronavirus and publish additional information pertaining to where coronavirus was. So in that resolution, we called Notre Dame to regularly publish and make available internal modeling Notre Dame was using about the spread of COVID-19. We were concerned about what things were going to look like. We weren't getting very much transparency. And that was a concern, I think, that was on everybody's mind. And then we also saw that Cornell had been releasing detailed modeling before they came back. They'd been open sourcing it. They'd been putting it out there. And we weren't getting the same amount of transparency from Notre Dame. We also wanted to know, and I think the person you had on your segment earlier, Maria, mentioned this, where cases were. Mm-hmm. So where are they in dorms? how many people are in quarantine and isolation units, how many students have coronavirus actively, and what are surveillance testing statistics looking like? So that's sort of what the resolution did.
So when you crafted this resolution, you know, what is the biggest concern on your mind?
On my mind, on August, right before August 20th, we're starting to see a spike in cases. We're getting back. We don't really have a very effective mass testing protocol. And we're concerned whether or not we're going to stay here, whether or not we're going to stay in school, whether or not it's going to be safe, what it's going to look like. And a lot of students have made the assumption, well, look, Notre Dame has to figure, they have to have some estimation of what they expect. So we wanted that information. And we also wanted to know, where are the hotspots? What's going on? Is my dorm at risk? Am I at risk by living in this dorm? Mm-hmm. And we occasionally got that by accident. Whenever somebody was sent into quarantine, at least in my dorm, there was a big sign posted on their door saying, this room needs to be cleaned and sanitized. But aside from checking those, we didn't really know how students were doing.
Wow. So has the university's transparency changed after the introduction of this resolution? Have you heard from administrators?
So I personally haven't heard from administrators. They typically don't respond directly to the senator. They work more with higher up student government officials. So that's mm-hmm. the student body president and vice president. There's a committee of involving a few of them. But what has changed in terms of their actions, they've updated the dashboard. The dashboard, when it first came out, didn't really have all that much on it. It sort of had how many cases have tested positive since, I want to say it's August 3rd is when they started. They didn't have any distribution by type of case or by location. They've added the distribution of across students, faculty, and staff. They haven't added the location data. And they've also added a few more gizmos up there. They've been a little bit more transparent there, but they definitely haven't done everything that we've asked for. And they have not released internal modeling.
So you mentioned that, you know, Cornell had some measures in place. Do you think there were specific mistakes made by the university as they planned to reopen?
Yeah. And there were some pretty big ones early on. I don't understand quite the strategy that they had with surveillance testing. Their idea was everybody's going to take a test before they come back. They're going to take one test. And if everybody takes it correctly, we're going to be able to lower the number of cases that enter the Notre Dame community. And that makes sense. The issue is there's actually a lot of variation that can go wrong with that. People can take the tests wrong. You can, after taking the test, contract it at a mass party, which is, it's my understanding that occurred. And also, you don't really know what cases are picked up during travel. There was no testing when you immediately came back to campus. There was nothing that required a double negative. That's something that Cornell was assuming in its modeling. So we didn't have surveillance testing. We also didn't have all that much transparency, and it was hard to get a test early. I had a friend, and he was quoted, I think, by WSBT, which is an ABC affiliate, I want to say out of South Bend, that he couldn't get a test even though his girlfriend had tested positive and they'd been together over an entire night unmasked. It took him a long time to get that test. So there were a lot of those concerns early, issues with testing. It sounded like, and I'm from New Jersey, it sounded like I was back in New Jersey in mid-March when I first came here, and that was scaring a lot of students.
Wow. So obviously, you know, Notre Dame had to suspend those in-person classes for the first 2 weeks at the school year. Do you think things have gotten better since?
Yes. Part of it, and I think at the beginning of the broadcast, you mentioned that the administration wanted to really pin it on students for why it was failing. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that that's not entirely unfair, right? Students bear some of the responsibility. The administration bears some of the responsibility. We're all able to play a role in controlling the spread of COVID-19. But definitely what's happened since then is that both have gotten better. Students are not going to big, unmasked, off-campus parties. We understand that this can make people really sick. It's not fun, and we also understand the impending threat that school will close. The university is also, it seems like they've motivated a lot more personnel. They have people they call here ambassadors. They're people walking around in a green polo with a badge that will constantly enforce the rules, not in any sort of disciplinary way, but making sure in terms of preventative ways that students follow them. And then also, they've updated their policies. They've implemented surveillance testing. They have it effective. They're starting to actually test out spit testing, which would be able to increase the number of surveillance tests they do even more. And they've really been able to, and that is, I think, key to what's been happening. A lot of the spread was caused by large off-campus gatherings. It came back to campus through when people had meals. We hadn't had a lot of spread in classes, but we've been able to cut down on those sorts of transmission events, and that's been really helpful.
Certainly off-campus gatherings are still happening, though. No.
Oh, of course, right. Like, I can see, I live my dorm is fairly close to Main Circle, which is where a lot of cars will come into Notre Dame if they're getting picked up to go off campus. And you can tell when people are going out by the clothes they're wearing, and you can see people leaving campus to go off. But I do think that when people are going off, they're tending to do it in smaller groups. They're not going to mass parties where they don't know everybody there, and that helps. So maybe not everybody's perfectly complying, but we're doing a better job, and we're not entering into those sorts of massive 30, 40-person parties with people who you might, you know, mostly call close friends, but not everybody, somebody that you know. Those sorts of parties I haven't heard, but the smaller gatherings are definitely still happening.
You know, Notre Dame has students like yourself coming from all across the country. What did that look like, you know, when everyone's coming from their home state, from so many different places? Do you think that has an impact?
I do. I think that has a significant impact. I'm from New Jersey. The state is still very locked down. From what I understand, at least even through last week in New Jersey, you could not go into a restaurant, period. You could not go inside. You could have outdoor dining. You could not go into a bar that was inside. You could have go to an outdoor bar. This is very different than a state like Georgia, which has much fewer restrictions, or a state like Texas, which has reopened. And when you have these different cultures mixing together, you have different levels of comfort associated with different levels of risk. Right? I'm from New Jersey. I was pretty risk averse because my state got hit hard. It got hit quick, and it got hit in a way that we know what this thing can do. But not every state experienced that, and not every person who's in maybe a more rural area actually wound up experiencing early what this virus does. So you saw people from more lax states coming saying, Indiana, you know, they're in about the same situation my state is right now. Why should I take these additional precautions? And we learned very quickly why, but it did take some time.
You're surrounded by some rural area up there in South Bend. Have you heard from the community? Did the community have any issues with students returning?
A few things I've seen on social media before students were returning. There were certain community members who were really concerned. They expected us to go wild, to party, to spread the disease, but not just amongst ourselves, but the seed community cases. And to my knowledge, that's not something that's occurring. And if it's occurring, it's not doing so in great number. But there are also certain parts of this community that really require students to thrive. There's businesses like bars that are located near campus, restaurants near campus. And if students aren't there, they don't make any money. And now the bars do work in many ways counter to Notre Dame's plan. You don't want people unmasked inside in large numbers, consuming food and beverage, getting drunk, talking loud. But these bars also depend on students. So you have to figure that there are multiple things going on here. There are businesses and there's the public health, and sometimes those interests don't particularly align. But, you know, it really varies depending on who you are in the community. But I do think there was a sense of concern when people came back and when they saw the big spike that was occurring. I think a lot of people got worried.
And since that big spike, do you think students have changed their behavior somewhat?
Yeah, absolutely. People are not, again, going to massive off-campus parties. We are not seeing people on campus walking around without a mask. If you're running, you're supposed to have a mask on campus now. That's a university policy, and people are complying with that generally. In dorms, people are wearing masks all the time. We all have communal bathrooms and showers. So if I get out of my room and I live in a single and I'm on my way to the bathroom, I have to wear a mask all the way there, even if I'm going to go take a shower. And people are doing that by and large. That wasn't 100% the case when we first came back, but students have definitely changed their behavior for the better. I really do think that.
So it sounds like students are not necessarily having a difficult time complying with some of these regulations.
I would say it's very specific to the regulation, right? Mask wearing is something that's really easy to comply with. Just keep the mask on your face. Stay 6 feet apart from people. That can be a little harder if you're walking in a crowd or something like that. Coming out of the stadium after a football game, there was a big line, and I don't think anybody was distanced in it as we were leaving. But also, where we have a harder time complying is where there's a lot of drinking involved, it seems. Why? Because when people are drunk, they have less risk aversion. They also have less physical control and awareness of the spaces around them. And you see that at events like the football game. People want to have fun. People want to be close to each other. People want to really get loud. There was one guy who I saw a few rows in front of me. He would take his mask down so he could shout louder, which is the exact opposite of what you would want to do. But that's not something a rational, sober, well-thinking person does. So we're having, I think, in general, a better time with complying. But there are certain high-risk events. I wouldn't call the stadium necessarily high-risk. They're still going on. And there are times where students have to do things that maybe they're not well equipped to do.
I mean, yes, a big part of Notre Dame student culture is attending those sporting events. You know, what other precautions are in place for those games? What does that look like today?
So in terms of those games, if you live in a room, you sit with the people in that room. If you live in a single, you're able to sit with up to three other people, and they clump you together in the stadium. Everybody else is at least 6 feet apart. So they pod you up to try to minimize big events of spread. They assign you a seat. You're supposed to stay in it the whole game. Now, compliance with that was not great. I could see in the lower bowl, for example, the top seemed pretty empty towards the end of the game, but the bottom was pretty packed. So you saw people slowly creeping down. But other sorts of precautions that the university have taken have been really good. You're not allowed to tailgate on campus. No events in the parking lot. They're pretty strict. If you're underage and you're drinking out on the quads, they're going to come after you, especially on game day. And that's something that the university, I think, is doing better with, but also providing alternatives. So investing in a lot of furniture for outdoor places, outdoor fireplaces, having a lot of outdoor events so that people can do something and do something fun rather than simply going to an off-campus indoor party.
Certainly life in Dillon Hall must look a lot different these days. How has that changed since coming back to campus this year?
It's definitely different. I'm not hanging out in my friends' rooms all the time. I'm not playing as many of the same games with people. We're not, in sort of those physical sports. A big part of our dorm culture is intersection sports. So each dorm is divided into a few sections. We typically play something like section football with each other. The dorm has athletic teams that compete against other dorms. One that I would play on is our tackle football team. And these are all sanctioned by the university typically, but we don't have the same level of that this year. So the community feels, we talk about social distancing, but also, we're more socially distant, not just physically distant. And that's how it feels. It is in many ways the same, though. You're still getting that sort of aspect of solidarity. It's just we have to keep apart. I'm seeing good compliance, but that means I'm not allowed in people's rooms, mm-hmm. or I'm not allowed to have a lot of people in other people's rooms.
How else are students, engaging with each other socially then? I imagine you have to be pretty creative while complying with COVID regulations.
Yeah. So as I mentioned before, there's a big space the university has invested in. Library quad, the quad in front of the Hesburgh Library, has been turned into library lawn. They put out a bunch of lawn chairs, fireplaces. They put up a stage there so people could do karaoke, obviously with the stage pretty far back from the crowd. They're really trying to make spaces outdoors on campus available for people to use on Friday nights and Saturday nights. They don't want people going off. But they're providing a lot of these outdoor spaces, and it's been really good. Clubs have had a really hard time doing on-campus programming sanctioned by the university because it's really hard to get an indoor space, and you can't do all the same things. But when you're outdoors, you have a lot more freedom. A lot more people will enjoy those nights, and those are things the university is doing towards achieving that end.
Do you know of any resources that may be available for students that are dealing with, the emotional and the mental toll of the pandemic?
Yeah, so we have a university counseling center on campus. Its resources are being stretched right now. People are a lot worse off than they were last semester or two semesters ago, right? We're in a very different world. It might be more difficult to make friends, and people are stressed for a number of reasons. But they've done a good job at going to online counseling sessions, being able to provide for online group therapy. That's something one of my friends does. But the Senate has criticized them for being slow. We sent out a resolution, I want to say it was sponsored by a girl named Grace Franco and a few others, that said we need to do better. So they're doing things, they're adjusting, they've changed their protocols, but students are not 100% satisfied with that.
Do you think generally people feel safe on campus now?
People feel safe in the sense of physical safety, I would say so.
Yeah.
The on-campus community really, with maybe one possible exception, has not experienced an outbreak. It's largely been confined to the off-campus community or people who were in direct contact with people who were off-campus, or maybe one level beyond that. But we haven't seen sustained dorm community spread yet. There's one dorm, which I won't name, but an email was sent out to their residents saying, hey, your dorm has twice the number of cases of any of the other 30-plus dorms on campus. We're going to surveillance test all of you. And lo and behold, the day that they surveillance tested, a lot of them, there was a spike in cases associated with surveillance testing. So generally, I think people feel that they're safe. There's not this big risk of transmission in the dorms or on campus, but we do have to be careful and we can't be complacent. That's the feeling that's going around.
And are you optimistic for the rest of the semester?
I'm optimistic we'll be able to stay here. You know, whether or not we have to eventually, for example, return to that pause, I think really depends on student compliance and also how things change with the winter. As the weather gets colder, a lot of those outdoor alternative programming activities are going to be harder and harder to do. You're going to get fewer people. If it's 40 degrees out, people are not going to want to go sit outside and play spike ball. Mm-hmm. They're probably going to want to be inside somewhere. They're probably going to want to gather in larger numbers.
Michael Dugan.
So there is a fight.
I'm sorry, I have to interrupt you. You were just fantastic today. Senior Dylan Hall, Senator, the University of Notre Dame, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll be back after a quick break to talk with public health experts working with universities to organize their testing and mitigation strategies. If you have questions or comments, you can find us at Facebook or Twitter, All in Indiana. I'm Jill Sheridan, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan in for Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on COVID-19 on college and university campuses across the state. As always, we'd love to hear your questions and comments, especially if you're a student or a parent. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. We're joined now by two guests. We have Brian Dixon, Director of Public Health Informatics at Regan Street Institute, and also Associate Professor of Epidemiology at IU School of Public Health. Welcome, Brian.
Good afternoon. Glad to be here.
And Graham McKean is Assistant University Director of Public and Environmental Health Department at Indiana University. Welcome, Graham.
Thanks, Jill. And hey, Brian.
Thank you both so much for joining today. Important work that you're doing, obviously, at the universities. Graham, I'd like to start with you. If you could tell us a little bit about the work you do for Indiana University's COVID efforts.
Sure. And it's a little bit of everything, as this has consumed all of us. And, you know, public health is so broad, especially during times like a global pandemic. And so we've really been involved in every asset and every facet of response, environmental health and safety of the department in which I work. But we've developed various teams. We have a medical and public health response team. We have an army of contact tracers. We do case reviews. And a big portion of the work I've been involved in the last month and a half or so is to helping with the testing and all of our different testing platforms. And so you know, we heard earlier about maybe a lack of, and now an effort to get to surveillance testing. And we saw that as a very critical component of being successful. Mm-hmm. In a place like a college campus in a country that has kind of failed to contain this virus, right? So the models show, you need to test students maybe about twice a week. We're not quite there at IU. We're very close. Most of these students have been tested once a week, especially if you live in a Greek house or a dorm. So we have various platforms. We've got a symptomatic pathway through IU Health that if anytime you have symptoms, you can get on the virtual hub and get a test that way. We also did probably one of the larger antigen testing operations for on-arrival testing for anybody living in a residence hall or a Greek house. We were able to give them a rapid test prior to move-in to start with that lower viral load. Mm-hmm. Quickly from the last day before school, then the first day of school, moved to the surveillance testing and mitigation testing style approach, where some of that early data that we did, we got over 33,000 tests done at IU Bloomington alone prior to school starting, really kind of informed us of where we could maybe upweight or where we'd want to look and see maybe where we'd want to put more resources in testing. And we saw that pretty quickly with some of these congregate living settings, especially the housed student organizations. And we saw an uptick there. And so that's really kind of helped us keep an eye on that and try to mitigate some of that going forward. And some of the good things that we're seeing now is it's very early, of course, and what we've learned in this pandemic is to kind of wait a while to look at the data, and Brian can talk about that more, but we are seeing this trend downwards. So that's allowing us to wait, vary and upweight and change some of the different groups that we are surveilling. We're doing this across all eight campuses. So it's a huge effort, a lot of people involved, and so
we're out there in every aspect of this response right now.
Yeah, it was amazing when the testing began and to start hearing about, you know, just the amount of testing that you were doing there. And it's obviously so important. Brian, in the early part of the pandemic, when we were all just wondering what was going to happen, students back on college campus was a big question mark. But, you know, what convinced the university that, you know, it was safe to reopen?
Yeah, so we looked at a lot of data from other countries and other universities, and we looked at a number of models that had been created, and we all sort of, from all this data that we gathered, we realized that if the university put certain precautions into place, even though, you know, there would be, you know, the number of cases would not be zero, the number of cases could be mitigated to a point where we could have students and faculty and staff on campus in a safe environment so that we could limit the spread of the disease. Those models really kind of helped inform our decisions that we could do things in a way that would be safe and that would allow us to have kind of in-person classes. Because when we talk to students and faculty and staff and parents, the overwhelming majority of people wanted the face-to-face classes. They wanted to be there in person. Many people prefer to learn that way, and they didn't want to have everything be 100% virtual.
And do you think that was the right move, you know, back to in-person instruction?
I think it was the right move. I mean, even though we've seen numbers go up initially when people came back, many of us expected that to happen because you've had people largely living in other places, not just around the state, but outside of the state and around really the world, right? We have some international students who were coming back to campus. And so we realized that when you take people from various places, bring them together in one spot, it was likely that there would be some transmission. But we saw that occur. It's now starting to go down. And in fact, we're seeing data across the state of Indiana that for individuals aged 18 to 24 years old, the number of cases are going down. So we're seeing not only at the community level, but also on our college campuses, that these mitigation strategies that have been put into place, they're beginning to work.
Graham, could you talk a little bit about, you know, how early IU started preparing to reopen? Was it right after the pandemic hit and everyone went home in the springtime? I mean, that there was so much talk about it then.
It's really kind of been interesting thinking back. I really recall with some colleagues around the office on my first day back on January 6th, and we're all just kind of nerding out about hearing this viral pneumonia of unknown, origin at a central animal market in Wuhan, China, and that just kind of piques our interest. And it kind of, you know, was like, okay, this could have pandemic potential, and it was really just kind of looking at afar. And of course, we have 6,000 international students. Of course, we had thousands of domestic students studying abroad. And so it really was, that was kind of the initial response. And then it moved to, we know it's here, we're not testing enough, and we got to figure out how we can maybe potentially de-densify if we have to and get all that. And so really that focus up until that point around spring break in March was really kind of global and then more preparation for the current issue and what was happening. And then we kind of shuttered there for a while and we're all in our homes and it was kind of a dark time. And I think a lot of that, we kind of woke up one day, not that we weren't busy and very active in this response, but shifted to, oh my goodness, what are we going to do this fall? And, that was more, I'd say, end of March, beginning of April, and got intensified in mid-April. And so our president, President McRobbie, set up a committee with Dean Hess that both Brian and I are on, the Restart Committee. And since then, we've had, our incident management team has been meeting at least a few times a week since January 23rd. Our Emergency Operations Center has been activated since around that time as well, and still kind of in a steady state now. And so this planning has been nonstop. It's 12, 14, 16-hour days. And it got really intense. I think, we saw these case numbers go down. Things were looking like they were improving. And that's because, stay-at-home orders worked and people were following the guidelines. Mm-hmm. And in May and early June, things looked like okay, and we were kind of thinking ourselves and maybe fooling ourselves that okay, we're getting towards a containment, and maybe we can get enough testing and enough contact tracing to do this. And clearly, that didn't happen nationally. And so that really intensified and refocused our efforts towards asymptomatic testing as much as possible and getting towards, and we're still working towards that. We're building 3 in-house labs now to get to that level of twice a week for students, once a week for faculty and staff at a minimum. But that's not all you have to do, right? So much of this, yes, it's testing and it's a data issue and a tech issue. It's surprising how much of that has come into the pandemic, but there's still so much to say about the boots on the ground, the old school public health, the case investigations, the digging and the data, the contact tracing, and having the ability to isolate and quarantine people. So all of those things really, I think, became more of an intense focus as we got closer to the semester.
Brian, can you talk a little bit about the types of tests that universities are using? They're changing so often.
They are. Well, the tests are, the labs are coming up with new tests all the time as well and introducing them into the marketplace. But at this point, what we've seen is universities are using the full range of tests that are available. So many of us are familiar with the nasal swab test that the State Department of Health and many public health agencies are using around the world to do testing. And that's considered kind of the gold standard of testing. But to do testing at scale, like Graham was talking about, to the thousands of students every week, we have and many other universities have begun to use saliva-based testing, which does have FDA approval. And even though it's potentially slightly less sensitive than the nasopharyngeal swab, it's still, you're able to do it a lot faster and a lot cheaper. The same thing with antigen testing, which is a much rapid test. We've heard a lot about these rapid tests now being offered in various places. The president has talked about the rapid test, becoming more available. And I think we'll see more of that being done both in the consumer market this fall and winter. But universities are really kind of the early testing ground for acquiring some of that equipment, putting them to use to test students. So, for example, the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana is testing every student every week. They're running 20,000 tests a day, and those are all saliva-based tests. And so it's just becoming very normal for college students on that campus to get up in the morning, sit in a tube, and submit their tests. So these are the kinds of tests that college campuses are using around the country.
Yeah, it is so interesting to see, how it's being done on campus and how that could hopefully be a model for the real world someday. Graham, what would you say is the biggest challenge behind getting as much testing as you want or need?
Staffing, logistics, probably being the biggest. This is a massive effort, and a lot of these collections, they have to be supervised. It's not like we're the ones conducting the MP swab on the person, but they all have to come down to a location, or we have to go to them, or some of these we've been doing in some of our Greek houses that are in quarantine, where we're coming to them and supervising that collection remotely on Zoom over video. And so a lot of it's just the logistics and staffing, and there's also a huge reporting and data component of this as well, not only from the labs to the state, but also within our own systems. Since we are doing first-tier contact tracing at the university, we have a software platform where all this data dumps into as well. And so it's just a lot of work for a lot of people that, clearly a few months ago did not think they would be doing this this school year. But I'd say that's probably been the biggest challenge.
Brian, with the contact tracing, are you able to tell that these cases are indeed coming from social gatherings, or able to identify what the largest contributors of spread are?
Yes, for the most part, we were able to actually, and Grant could probably talk a little bit more about his team's efforts to getting contact with students at IU, but generally contact tracing that public health does is able to, reach out to people, get a hold of them who've been the ones who've been tested positive, and talk to them about their situations. And that's how we know, for example, that a lot of the spread happens at weddings and funerals and family reunions and other social gatherings. We've seen that across the state of Indiana, and we've seen that in other states as well. So the people are generally honest when they're talking to you. They may not give you the names of every person they know, but generally if they've been at some kind of event like that, those are specific questions the contact tracers are asking them. And you're able to gather details like that from people.
And Graham, likewise, that contact tracing at some of the Greek houses, I would imagine, it's pretty clear.
It is. And, you know, we've had really great success, I would say, in being able to contact and get them to be responsive and help us out in that investigation. And again, that goes back to that. So much of this still has to be done manually and old school. And we have a 9 o'clock meeting 5 days a week with myself and some others in our case management team and in our medical response team that are reviewing charts and reviewing cases all day, trying to find those leakages. We have the ability to pull location visits for people that say where they were while they were infectious. And so we look at those. And so it can be hours a day for some of us at IU. I'm not gonna lie about that, but we do see that as vital. And that's just additional information that we can use and provide for our communications, for messaging, weekly emails and education, as well as trying to identify additional areas that maybe we want to upweight or oversample the following week. There's a separate group where we meet with some of the EPIs and biostatisticians to kind of weight those every week across all the 8 campuses where we are testing.
Mm-hmm. Brian, could you talk about any concerns you've heard from faculty or staff about in-person instruction? And, what does the testing look like for those people?
Yeah, so I think initially, certainly, we saw a lot of concern, at the end of last school year and over the summer, just because there weren't a lot of details. It took a long time. Graham mentioned the amount of planning that went into making the fall semester run safely and smoothly, or at least as safely and smoothly as we can make it. And so there was a lot of concern from people when they first came back to campus about how it would be. I think at this point, through communication channels and otherwise, many people are starting to feel safe. You heard that from, I think, the students earlier in the program. People are becoming more comfortable with this new way of life. At the front of lecture halls, there were plexiglass sort of stands put in so those professors could, if they wanted to, stand behind those. Obviously, students are social distanced in the classroom. Students also have the option, the flexible option of joining via Zoom. So I think universities have tried to put into place as much kind of precautions and alternatives and flexibility as possible so that people can kind of spread out and the professor doesn't have to, walk up and down the classroom and potentially be exposed. They can kind of be in one place and isolated, and also, adjusting expectations around, office hours and having more virtual sessions with students, like virtual working sessions, has been ways that make people more comfortable with, yes, you can be in the classroom for your lectures and for the hands-on activities, but then putting some of these other things in place to allow you to work one-on-one with students, in a safe way.
Such interesting work that you're doing. That's going to have to be it for today. I do want to thank all of our guests for taking time today. Thank you right now to Brian Dixon, Director of Public Health Informatics at Regenstrief Institute and also Associate Professor of Epidemiology at IUPUI School of Public Health. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
And Graham McKean, Assistant University Director of Public and Environmental Health Department at Indiana University. Thanks, Graham.
Thanks, Jill.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow for the Friday Pitch-In. Matt Pelser will be back. We can catch up on some of the biggest Indiana news of the week. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. Again, I'm Jill Sheridan, filling in for Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All in Indiana.